From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. On today's edition of Fresh Air, I speak with screenwriter Hanif Qureshi. He wrote the 1985 surprise hit My Beautiful Laundrette. His new film, Sammy and Rosie Get Laid, premieres this Friday. Also today, I speak with actor Ned Beatty. Since his screen debut 15 years ago in Deliverance, Beatty has appeared in over 80 movie and TV roles. His latest role is the police chief in the film The Big Easy. Jazz critic Kevin Whitehead reviews a new album from trombonist Ray Anderson. And TV critic David Bianculli reviews Echoes in the Darkness, the upcoming CBS miniseries about the murder of a mainline Philadelphia schoolteacher and her two children. That's all coming up on today's Fresh Air. My guest is writer Hanif Qureshi. He wrote the screenplay for the film My Beautiful Laundrette. It was originally produced for Channel 4 television in England, but it was released theatrically and became a surprise hit in America. The movie is about a young man of Pakistani descent coming of age in London. It's about fascists and punks, racial and economic oppression, violence, crime, sex and drugs, but it's a comedy. Qureshi's new film, Sammy and Rosie Get Laid, opens Friday in New York. As you can guess, the title has created a lot of controversy, and we'll talk about that in a moment. The film is about a Pakistani politician who returns to London where he was educated, but when he gets there, it's not the London he remembers. There is rioting, and the streets are literally on fire. Both of Qureshi's screenplays were directed by Stephen Frears, who also directed Prick Up Your Ears, the acclaimed film about playwright Joe Wharton. Hanif Qureshi was born in a suburb of London to a Pakistani father and an English mother. I spoke with him earlier today from the NPR Bureau in New York. I told him that I think Americans have come to turn to British films for high culture and refinement, like the world we see on Masterpiece Theatre, but the London of his films is very different.
Yeah, that's very interesting because a lot of English cinema is associated with a kind of view of Britain that seems to me to be rather outdated. I'm thinking of films like, say, Passage to India or Room with a View or Maurice or the Raj films, I think, which you've had in the United States, or Brideshead Revisited. These are all films that show Britain at a certain stage of her great glory, and they're about rich people generally ruling over poor people, usually in India. Our low-budget films are quickly made. They're, I suppose, punk films. They're made about kids on the street. I suppose they're like punk records you might make in a garage, kids getting together. They're made very quickly and cheaply. And our idea, I suppose, is to show the lives of Britain today, the lives of young people in Britain today. There's been a number of these films, like My Beautiful Laundrette, Letter to Brezhnev, Wish You Were Here, Personal Services, Another Country, Rita Sue and Bob Too, and now Sammy and Rosie Get Laid. So these new films are an attempt, financed by television, are an attempt to show a new Britain, a Britain from the bottom, as it were.
Are you showing the London that you feel you know best?
Yeah, that's the London of the streets I know, and it's a London that's not usually represented on film. It's about, often, these films are about people who are normally excluded from the cinema. For example, the lives of Asian people, or the lives of gay people, or the lives, in Sammy and Rosie, partly, of lesbian people. One of the things that's happened in Britain in the last 20 years is that there's been a whole wave of immigrants who've come from Pakistan, from India, from the West Indies. And these people's lives haven't been portrayed in the cinema yet, and their lives seem to me to be very interesting, very rich, full of conflict and drama, and full of interesting relationships between colonialism and Britain. So that's the aim of our cinema.
You know, I'm almost surprised that your first film, My Beautiful Laundrette, got funded. So many movies are package deals now, and the producers try to see if this movie will have a wide demographic appeal. So you go and make a movie about a Pakistani in England who is gay and runs a laundry. It's not exactly wide demographic appeal written all over that.
You wouldn't have thought so before it was made.
Exactly, right.
What you have to do when you're making films, is be adventurous. If I'd gone to a big producer and said, look, I'm making a film about a gay Pakistani who runs a laundrette, give me $2 million. They'd never have given us the money. But these films All of these low-budget films I've described are financed by Channel 4, financed by television. So they're made very cheaply, but also they're made not to make a profit. We're not trying to hit the jackpot with this film. We're not trying to, with any of our films. We're not trying to make Gandhi. We're trying to make films that cover their costs and make a little bit of money. But mostly we're interested in making good films, in telling the stories that we want to tell. But we're not really interested in pulling in $50 million. We know we can't do that, but we hope there's room in the market for our films.
You know, even the title of your new film is controversial. The title is Sammy and Rosie Get Laid. Now, the last I heard, the Motion Picture Association of America had refused to register the title because of the last word of the title. What's the status now? Is it still unregistered in the MPAA?
Well, thank God that you've had the courage to mention the title, the full title of the film on the radio. We never anticipated there'd be such a fuss about the title of this film. We didn't think the words "get laid" would cause such a, you know, people to fall into a fury and start foaming at the mouth. And the New York Times and the LA Times and so on won't publish it in their advertising. Although yesterday they published it in their advertising, but didn't publish it in their advertising, but published it in their editorial. So it's very weird. And it's upset us a lot because I think it's so stupid.
So is it still unregistered?
It's still unregistered, yes. I don't know how that affects this particular film. The film, the title is supposed to indicate that the film is ironic. It's full of jokes. It's a comedy. It's light, and there's a sort of rebelliousness about the title we like. I think maybe they should just call it Sammy and Rosie Get.
Why didn't you change the name though when you realized that there was going to be trouble advertising it and there was going to be a big controversy?
Because I would never have called the film Sammy and Rosie. I would have called it something altogether different if we hadn't been able to use the Get Laid. So it's come a bit late, all this, really.
How would you describe the theme of that new movie?
It's about a young couple, Sammy and Rosie, who live in South London, who are joined in South London by the father of Sammy, who comes from a third world country. He arrives in Britain on the night when riots break out in Brixton in South London. These riots are based on the actual shooting of a black woman called Cherry Gross by the police in Brixton. And the film is about the riots that follow it and the arrival of Rafi, played by Shashi Kapoor, in Britain on the night of the riots. He's a character who was in Britain at Oxford during the 50s and sees Britain as a very civilized, very tolerant, kind of Brideshead revisited place. And this film is his journey through South London, seeing the way it's changed, the kind of racial tensions there are, the kind of problems there are, and what life is like on the street.
Yeah, he says, before returning to England, he says, "Before I die, I must know my beloved London again. For me, it's the center of civilization, tolerant, intelligent, and completely out of control now, I hear."
Absolutely, and certainly out of control when he arrives, when he finds the first thing he sees are the streets on fire. In fact, he sends a postcard to his fondest relative saying, "Streets on fire, wish you were here."
In your first film, My Beautiful Laundrette, the Pakistani uncle describes England as this damn country that we hate and love.
Yes.
Does that sum up your feelings about England?
Not only my own feelings, but also the feelings of my father and some of my relatives that came to Britain from India and Pakistan in the late 40s and 50s, came to Britain to make money, to succeed, to find a place, to be educated and so on. But of course, Britain is such a difficult place to settle into. There is so much racism, so much prejudice. And also a lot of Indians and Pakistanis, as they get older, they miss the old country, they miss their family, they miss the relative, they miss the extended family, the idea of being surrounded by all your cousins, aunts, children, and so on. People in England live in rather, as they do in America generally, in families of two and three people. So it's a country where you can flourish, where you can make money, as the uncle does in The Laundrette. Yet at the same time, it's a country in which there are many problems and in which you never really feel at home. It's a country where, on the whole, white people in Britain don't like black people or Indian people or Pakistani people.
Now, your father was Pakistani, your mother is white. And I would presume that your father lived pretty comfortably in Pakistan if he was able to come to London for an education. Was he able to maintain that status in England?
No, he wasn't himself, though some other members of my family, like the uncle of mine who has the Laundrette, have been very successful. I mean, it is a country, I suppose, though to a lesser extent than the United States, where you can make money and succeed. One of the things you can't do in a country like Pakistan, really, it's more of a feudal country than a capitalist country, is to really succeed and make money. So one of the reasons why the Indians and Pakistanis came to Britain was to make money, to break away from their villages, from their families, from the feudal background, and to succeed. But of course that success has involved them completely changing their lives. I mean, it's been hard also on their children. You come to a country, you find that your children are different to you. They don't follow the same religion. They go out with boys and girls. They start taking drugs. They don't live in the way they would have lived in India or Pakistan. So all this has led to innumerable conflicts and problems and drama, which is one of my subjects as a writer.
So he wasn't able to keep up the status or level of lifestyle that he was accustomed to in Pakistan?
Not in the same way.
Did you grow up in a racially mixed neighborhood?
I grew up in an all-white neighborhood. I was the only little brown face in my neighborhood and the only little brown face in my school.
There was pretty strong anti-Pakistani sentiments in England in the 1960s, and I think there were even marches against Pakistani immigration.
Yeah, one of the themes of The Laundrette, between, if you remember, the two boys, Johnny and Omar, is that Omar joined a right-wing organization and would take part in marches through South London. And Omar describes seeing him on these marches. These marches did take place in Britain, mostly influenced by a politician called Enoch Powell, who was very right-wing, very racist, who was at one time in the Tory cabinet. And The Laundrette is partly to do with that theme of someone like me growing up with white kids who then often joined right-wing organizations and how hard that was for me.
So that happened to you. You had friends who joined right-wing organizations and who marched in anti-immigration marches and who became very racist.
Yeah, well, after school they used to go out beating up Pakistanis. They go out, it was called paki bashing. It was a kind of, you go to a dance, you get drunk, and then you go out and beat up Pakistanis, something I myself never took part in.
Well, so were you able to keep these friends? Did you want to keep these friends once they
Well, I kind of, my ambition was always to sort of escape from the suburbs, really, and to be a writer and to lead the leisurely life I now lead.
Is this a working-class suburb we're talking about, or a middle-class suburb?
It's lower middle-class, I suppose.
You've written in an autobiographical piece that you tried to deny your Pakistani self. Would you explain that?
Well, I suppose for a long time I thought of it as a kind of an affliction, this terrible thing that had happened to me, that had been done to me by other people. I didn't really see it as a social problem. I didn't see it as it is, really. It's a problem of white people who are racist, and it's some kind of psychosis that they have to work out for themselves. I saw it as being my own problem and didn't see it as being something I had in common with anybody else. It was a very personal thing. One of the things that gave me courage and hope in the 60s, actually, were organizations like the Black Panthers in the United States, people like James Baldwin, Angela Davis, and so on. And I turned to them, really, in my reading for support, encouragement.
When did you start writing, and when did you become interested in art?
I suppose in my teens, really. I was very interested in writers like Baldwin. It was also a way of expressing something, a kind of complex anger in yourself, or a desire to work out what's happening to you. Writing, as you probably know, is a way of making strong feelings into weaker ones. It's a way of capturing, expressing, and making sense of your own anger or loss or unhappiness or whatever.
You know, in your movies, there are so many punks and Rastafarians, people of different ethnic backgrounds, gays, straights, and a lot of the people who populate your movies are people who are really outside of the mainstream, or at least on the fringes of it. And I wonder if when you moved to London, you became involved in people who lived on the fringe of the mainstream, and if you felt more comfortable there.
Well, these are all... Yeah, someone once said to me, you write about all these people that are kind of immoral, terrible people. And I thought, well, these are all my friends, really. These are people I hang out with. I'm obviously in with the wrong crowd. But the people that I know and like are generally people who stand up to things, who are odd, who are individual, who don't conform, who are defiant and rebellious. Because that seems to me to be, these are people who are lively, who are awake, who don't go along with the general stream. That's what I like in life.
You know,
I come from the suburbs where everybody dresses the same, talks the same, does the same job. I hate all that. It's dead. I couldn't bear it. And so I've always been drawn towards the freakish, the individual, the defiant, and the sexually odd, especially.
Well, you know what I'm guessing? I'm wondering if in circles like that where people are really, odd and outside of the mainstream, if they're more accepting of each other, or if there's still a certain amount of racism and sexism even in that fringe culture.
Oh, there is. A lot of Pakistanis and Indians are very condescending of each other, Pakistanis. The Indians were great fans of My Beautiful Laundrette because they said, oh, we always knew Pakistanis were just like that, you know.
Oh,
Pakistani men were always kissing each other. We knew that. You didn't have to tell us. So there is an enormous amount of prejudice. It's part of human nature, I suppose.
My guest is Hanif Qureshi. He's a screenwriter whose movies include My Beautiful Laundrette and a new film that opens this week titled Sammy and Rosie Get Laid. We're going to talk some more after this short break. This is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is produced live at WHYY in Philadelphia and distributed by National Public Radio.
Screenwriter Hanif Qureshi is my guest. He's joining us from the NPR Bureau in New York. You went to Pakistan, I guess, what were you, in your 20s or so?
Yeah, in my late 20s, in the early 80s, yeah.
Did it fit your image, which you had, the image that you developed living in London?
It was a very, very complicated place to visit for me because it's a place where I had an enormous number of relatives, friends, cousins, aunts, uncles, and so on, who I'm deeply fond of and who loved me as well. So going there, I had an enormously warm welcome, and I felt part of the place. I wasn't just a tourist wandering around, lying on the beach. I felt part of the society. On the other hand, it is a right-wing Islamic dictatorship in which the attitudes to the poor, to the unemployed, to women, and so on, are attitudes that I abhor. It's not a liberal society in the least. There are no decent films. You can't get any books. The newspapers are full of figures on steel production. It's a society that doesn't look at itself in the way that Western society does attempt to look at itself, examine itself up to a point. So I felt a lot of very strong emotional feelings towards the place, which were warm, and yet at the same time I felt deeply alienated politically because I couldn't understand why there were so many soldiers carrying guns on the street.
It must have been interesting, though, for you to be in a place where Pakistanis weren't a minority group.
Well, they certainly weren't a minority, no. I felt, as an Englishman, in a minority, and I felt my own views to be rather bizarre and unique in such a place.
Right. Was there much of an art scene there? Did being a writer give you any status while you were there?
No, it didn't. It had the opposite effect, actually. When I told people, when I was with my family, and I told strangers and friends of the family that I was a writer, my family would try and explain that this didn't mean what they thought. You know, they thought being a writer was being a kind of bum, somebody who really was unemployed and liked to stay at home and listen to records, which is, of course, true.
You wrote My Beautiful Laundrette while you were in Pakistan, is that right?
Yes, I did. The people in Pakistan, really, who have status are people like doctors, people in the army, lawyers, some university professors, and so on. But on the whole, the arts are not considered to be a respectable or responsible thing to be doing. It's rather like, I suppose, France in the 19th century.
In your new movie, Sammy and Rosie Get Laid, one of the main characters is a Pakistani politician, a powerful man who comes to America to visit family. Is this character, this powerful politician with blood on his hands, is this character based on anyone you know?
He's not really. I mean, I know he's a man that comes to Britain to see what it's like after 30 years. He's a man with a very interesting, complicated past, someone who, in fact, has got, as you say, blood on his hands, someone who's tortured someone else. It isn't that he's based on anyone specific. It's only that I'm interested in the idea of torture and what that means and how you live your life if you do it, what kind of people do this, how ubiquitous it is in the world, and how you may have to come to terms with it yourself if you found that somebody close to you was doing it. After all, there are many people in the world who do torture other people. I'm interested in what their wives or their children or their husbands or their family think of that. So that's the kind of central dilemma of the film.
When you started writing, were you ever afraid that you'd have to find a way to write about subjects that were considered mainstream and popular for the time? Did you always know that you could write from your own heart, from your own experiences?
Well, I've only ever done that. I'm not interested in being a professional screenwriter. I don't really consider myself to be a screenwriter. I'm a journalist. I write a lot of fiction. I write plays. and so on. I work in a number of areas. Screenwriting is only one area that I'm interested in. I don't want to be a screenwriter. I just write screenplays because there are these stories I want to tell. And I also want to reach a large audience, which is the thing you can do with screenplays that you can't do if you have a story in The New Yorker, say. It's obviously a different kind of audience. So we use screenplays, we use the cinema, Stephen Frears and I, who directs my films, as a way of telling our stories and getting people sexually excited and reaching a large audience.
You know, you had said earlier that one of the things that interests you was sexuality. I forget exactly the way you put it. But I had read somewhere that when you were getting started as a writer to make money before you could actually sell your own novels or screenplays, you were writing pornographic films or pornographic books.
I didn't write pornographic films. I used to write the stories that went between the pictures, to my enormous shame and to the embarrassment of my friends. It was something I did for a while under the name of Antonia French, actually.
Did it succeed in giving you enough money to write your own
Yeah, story? But one of the things, yes, it did. I got money to do other things I wanted to do, but it made me realise that the most important thing to me was my writing, and if you prostitute that, it is the worst thing you can do.
Maybe there was a time when you thought you'd never get out, that you'd be stuck doing hack work or worse.
Absolutely. I mean, the thing about being a writer is that you never know what's going to happen, whether you are going to be successful or not. You just have to carry on, be dedicated, believe in what you're doing and stick at it to the end of your life, really. In the end, all I want to do is to write sentences that are beautiful, sentences that appeal to me, sentences that say something and are structurally gorgeous, as it were.
Both of your films have been directed by Stephen Frears, who also directed Prick Up Your Ears. How did you hook up with him?
Well, when I wrote My Beautiful Laundrette, when it was commissioned by Channel 4, they said, this is great, we want to make this film, and so on. So I went round to Stephen's house with the script and dropped it through his letterbox and said, this is this film I've written, Channel 4 want to make it, do you want to direct it? So he called me up and said, come over, and I went over, and he said, this is good. He said, I'll make this. He said, but only on one condition. And I said, what? He said, only on the condition that we make this film for television. It never plays in the cinema.
Why didn't he want it to be in the cinema?
He was afraid of hybrids. He was afraid of making a film that was neither a television film nor a cinema film. And he thought that some of the films that had been made, like The Plowman's Lunch or whatever, for the cinema, hadn't fully succeeded as cinema films. How wrong could you be? I remember that story when I was nominated for an Oscar.
Well, did you tell him no?
Well, I agree with him. I said, okay, fine, whatever you like. I was so glad to get the film made at all. It was only later when it was shown at the Edinburgh Film Festival that we got it into the cinema. And it ran and ran for 18 months in London, actually.
Why did you choose him as the person you wanted to direct your films?
Because he's incredibly skillful as a cinema maker, but also as a filmmaker. But also he's got a great sense of humour. What we're interested in doing is writing very serious films about complicated subjects with complex, rounded characters who are neither good nor bad, set in very difficult moral positions, yet stories that are full of humour, full of life, full of humour, full of vigour, full of music, and are really lively. It's that combination that interests both of us.
You know, it's interesting that you are doing comedies, because usually films about racial and sexual and economic oppression tend to be very serious movies making serious points, but your films make those points through comedy. It's not slapstick. It's not a yuck-a-minute kind of comedy, but they are comedies.
Absolutely. I mean, the first time I ever heard someone laugh during a play of mine, that was it. I was turned on. I wanted that to happen all the time, because when people are laughing, I realize that people are listening as well.
Do you like to be on the set when you're getting shot?
Yeah, I'm on the set all the time. Stephen and I make these films together. They are collaborations. I mean, I write them and he directs them, but I'm always on the set. I'm involved in the casting. I'm involved in the cutting of the film. It's because we work well together. I say to him, or he says, what's happening in this scene? I say, so-and-so is happening in this scene. Or he says, oh, why don't you rewrite the end? Or I say, why don't you put the camera over there? So we do collaborate in every way. It's very unusual, in fact, in films for that to happen. In American films, generally, if you're the writer, you're lucky to get on the set at all. I can't understand that, because you can do so much writing and rewriting on the set.
You do a lot of rewriting on the set?
Yeah, I'd sit in the corner and I'd write a scene on hand out the pages to the actors, and then we'd shoot it straight away. You get a lot of ideas from the actors, what's going on between them, the kind of improvisations they're doing, the kind of jokes they tell in the canteen. It's very useful for a writer to be on a set. And it's very inspiring as well, because you've got like 10 minutes to write something and you write it in 10 minutes. It's just as good as if it had taken you 2 hours to do.
You know, one thing I really wanted to mention about My Beautiful Laundrette, two of the characters in there have a gay relationship with each other. And it happens midway through the movie, and they're kind of surprised by it. I think the audience is surprised by it. But it happens so naturally, and it's really not a big deal in the movie at all. It's like the love subplot of the movie.
Yeah,
nothing's really made of the fact that they are two gay men.
Yeah,
I mean, right? It's just done.
Yeah, it's about time that happened. I mean, being gay is not such a big deal as it used to be. I mean, so many people are gay, and they don't talk about it, or you know, it's just taken for granted, as heterosexual relationships are taken for granted. I wanted to do that in the film. I didn't want all the characters going around saying, "Oh God, I'm gay. What do I do? How do I tell my father? You know, where do I get my condoms?" I wanted to write a film in which this was as natural as any other form of sexuality, which it is, of course.
Did you talk to the actors about that, kind of ease that you wanted in the movie?
I didn't, actually. We never talked about it. They always sort of took it for granted, really. They thought it's part of the characters they were playing. We hardly ever mentioned it. Because it's not a gay film in that sense. The theme of the film isn't to do with being gay. It's to do with class. It's to do with being Asian in Britain. Being gay was their sexuality, but it wasn't made into some big theme, thank God.
Your new movie is about to open in America. Have you been to many American movie theaters?
Oh, yes, I have. Yeah, I go off and on. Yeah, I love American films.
Do American movie theaters seem different to you than English ones?
Well, in Los Angeles, you go into a movie theater and everyone's eating all the time. They're eating hamburgers, chips, drinking Coca-Cola, and they talk through the films, which is something that doesn't happen in England.
What do you do on an opening night? Are you going to be nervous about the opening?
Well, what's good, I used to write for the theater, so I really know what opening nights are like. I mean, in the theater, opening nights are terrifying, because usually on an opening night, the sets do fall down, the actors do forget their lines, or the costumes, or they can't get the doors shut, they've forgotten their costumes, and so on. What's good about a movie is that you know that nothing can go wrong. What's also interesting about a movie is that if you sit through a film, every audience is different, and the film seems different with a different audience. In Toronto, for example, where I saw the film last time, the film was almost seen as a comedy, and people were roaring with laughter. They were really into it. Other audiences, after the shooting of the black woman at the beginning of the film, really shut up and are quiet throughout the film. So I'm interested to see what a New York audience will make of this film.
Will you be at a movie theater on opening night this Friday?
I may be. You may find me there, or you may find me in a bar.
If you go to
probably in a bar.
If you go to a theater, do you know what kind you'd pick? I guess you might not have a big choice in New York.
Absolutely. I don't know yet.
What are your new projects that you're working on?
Well, I've sort of retired now. I've done enough. I've had enough. I'm fed up with writing. There's so much trouble about the title of this film. I can't be bothered to make any more films or to write any more films. But funnily enough, whenever I decide to retire, when I think that's it, I've had enough, I get a new idea. So I do have a new idea for a film, which was going to be called, rather innocuously, I'm afraid, Hot to Trot, which I'm going to write at the moment, which will probably be about an Asian girl who goes to a third world country for the first time.
Well, I want to thank you very much for talking with us about your life and your work. Thank you for being with us.
Thank you very much.
My guest has been Hanif Qureshi. He's a screenwriter, novelist, and playwright. His movies are My Beautiful Laundrette and a new movie titled Sammy and Rosie Get Laid, which is scheduled to open this Friday in America. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. On our next show, I'll speak with Randy Schiltz. His new book, And the Band Played On, is a comprehensive look at the history and politics of the AIDS epidemic. Schiltz's research uncovered some startling new information, such as the identification of the person believed to have first brought AIDS to the United States. So I hope you can join us. Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY-FM in Philadelphia. This is NPR, National Public Radio. From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Coming up, actor Ned Beatty talks about his movie career. Beatty has played roles as diverse as the rape victim in Deliverance and a New Orleans police chief in The Big Easy. Also, jazz critic Kevin Whitehead reviews a new album from trombonist Ray Anderson. And television critic David Bianculli previews the CBS miniseries Echoes in the Darkness. It's based on the story of a schoolteacher and her children murdered in Main Line, Philadelphia. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news from National Public Radio.
I'm Sharon Green in Washington. The Dow Jones Industrial Average took its second biggest plunge ever, falling nearly 157 points. At the end of today's abbreviated session, the Dow stood at 1793.93. Declines outnumbered advances 17-1 on volume of 308 million shares. The Hong Kong Stock Exchange also took a nosedive today, losing about a third of its value, and share prices tumbled again on European markets. NPR's Bill Buesenberg has details.
Analysts in Europe say their declines were largely a reaction to what was happening in the Far East and their anticipation of what might happen on Wall Street. The steep fall earlier today in share prices on the Hong Kong Stock Exchange had been expected, since that market had been closed for a week, essentially storing up a major decline. But analysts in Europe say they were disappointed by a further decline in Tokyo today, which had not been expected. The declines in Asia also included share price tumbles in Sydney and Singapore. All of that helped produce an immediate drop when the London Stock Exchange opened this morning. Prices started off 100 points lower, and by midday, the London market was 122 points down. There is increased apprehension in Europe that the value of the dollar could collapse even if markets are able to stabilize. I'm Bill Buesenberg in London.
Amid growing concern about weakening financial markets, President Reagan and congressional leaders held an economic summit meeting at the White House today. They announced a political truce while they work out the details of a deficit reduction plan for the federal budget. The president met with Democratic and Republican lawmakers at the White House. Afterwards, Senate Democratic leader Robert Byrd said the White House and congressional leaders agreed to focus on ways to meet the budget reduction target in the Graham-Rudman law.
We also agreed that we not look backward, that we look ahead, that this be as nonpartisan as it can possibly be, and that we focus on the $23 billion in real reductions and 1988. If we can do better, then we want to do better.
Tomorrow, negotiations between the administration and Congress will get down to specifics at a closed-door meeting on Capitol Hill. In a Miami suburb, a man who apparently had lost heavily in the stock market walked into a Merrill Lynch brokerage office today and shot two employees before killing himself. The branch office manager was killed in the shooting, and a broker was rushed to a hospital in critical condition. The gunman has been identified as 53-year-old Arthur Kane, who branch employees say was a longtime customer. The head of El Salvador's Human Rights Commission was shot dead today. Police say Herbert Anaya was gunned down as he left his home in San Salvador. There are reports that Anaya may have fallen victim to right-wing death squads. The U.S. reacted angrily today to word that an Ethiopian rebel group has destroyed a convoy of trucks carrying 450 tons of emergency food to a drought-stricken area of Ethiopia. State Department spokesman Charles Redmond said there could have been no mistake that the convoy was on a relief mission.
The UN trucks and two of the Catholic Relief Services vehicles had been purchased with U.S. government funds. Deplore this outrageous action, which targeted trucks clearly marked with United Nations insignia and whose humanitarian mission is well and widely known by all persons in Ethiopia.
Redmond said it is quite clear the attack was carried out by one of the rebel groups fighting the country's Marxist government. He said the U.S. will continue its food relief efforts in spite of the attack. Hunger is said to be increasing among American blue-collar workers. In a study released today, the Physician Task Force on Hunger in America blamed the trend on Reagan administration policies, saying economic growth has failed to trickle down to U.S. workers. Task Force Chairman Dr. Leigh Jerry Brown estimates hunger affects 20 million Americans. I'm Sharon Green in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. Our jazz critic Kevin Whitehead has a review of a new album from trombonist Ray Anderson. Anderson first attracted attention in the late 70s when he played in a quartet led by composer and saxophonist Anthony Braxton. Anderson now leads his own groups and plays with the art funk band The Slickaphonics. He's usually considered an avant-gardist, but his last album was a set of jazz standards, and his latest album bridges the old and the new.
When the jazz avant-garde blossomed in the 1960s, some critics wrote that the unruly swarming of free jazz horns resembled the kind of improvising one heard in New Orleans traditional bands. The parallel was well-intentioned. It was meant to show that free music was an extension of the jazz tradition, not a break from it. And that last point is true. But on closer inspection, free jazz polyphony really didn't have much in common with the hierarchy of horns in Dixieland bands. In traditional groups, trumpet, clarinet, and trombone each had a specific assigned function. Free jazz horn players seldom observed such formal restraints. But now, trombonist Ray Anderson attempts to unite old and new jazz on his album It Just So Happens, recorded for Enja. For half the album, Anderson assembled a Dixie-like sextet with Stanton Davis on trumpet, Perry Robinson on clarinet, and Bob Stewart on tuba. The resulting sound might be called fake Dixieland. The horn parts have been written out to loosely emulate older models. Not that there's anything wrong with that. Jelly Roll Morton worked a similar vein in the 1920s. A good example of Anderson's fake Dixieland is his calypso, Raven's Jolly Jump Up. The other half of Ray Anderson's new album features a more streamlined quartet with Mark Dresser on bass, Ronnie Barrage on drums, and Stanton Davis on trumpet. But regardless of setting, as a soloist, Ray Anderson may come closer to old New Orleans values than any other young horn player in modern jazz. The early Louisiana jazzmen, like clarinetist Johnny Dodds, played crudely and out of tune, while younger musicians reviving the old style tend to display more polish. But in cleaning up their act, those later players have lost some of the power their elders wrung from crudely drawn musical lines. If you want a visual analogy to the old-timers' mix of the raw and the profound, think of the paintings of Jackson Pollock. Like an early jazz man, Ray Anderson exploits the trombone's potential for playing in the cracks between the notes of a scale. He uses a plunger mute for wah-wah effects and plays greasy slurs and deliberately out-of-tune notes to broaden his expressive range. On a Caribbean-tinged version of Edith Piaf's La Vie en Rose, Anderson constructs an elegant statement from just such ungainly materials. some listeners, Anderson's trombone will sound as pleasing as chalk scraped across a blackboard. Some people don't like Jackson Pollock either. But this is a century of rough grace in the arts. As Ray Anderson's echoes of early jazz remind us, such crafty primitivism has been a part of our artistic heritage for almost 100 years.
Kevin Whitehead is a regular contributor to Downbeat, Cadence, and Jazz Times. He reviewed Ray Anderson's new album, It Just So Happens, on the Angel label. You're listening to Fresh Air. My guest is Ned Beatty, who is one of Hollywood's most respected character actors. Beatty made his movie debut 15 years ago in Deliverance. Since then, he's been in close to 40 movies, in roles as diverse as an insensitive husband and father in Nashville, the chairman of the board in Network, and the police chief in The Big Easy. Beatty got his start as a stage actor working in regional theaters. He was a 15-year veteran of the stage before he made his first film. Beatty grew up in a conservative and religious home in Kentucky where singing in church was more important than going to the movies.
Going to films was a little bit frowned upon in my family, mostly when it was a nice day. Saturday was movie day for kids in those days, and it was a nice Saturday. My dad was not real thrilled with the idea of us going and sitting in a movie theater. So if he happened to be home, he's a traveling salesman, but if he happened to be home on a sunny Saturday, I didn't get to go to the movies. But I not only went to the movies, I lost my father. My father died when I was 15. And subsequently, pretty soon after that, I started to work at different jobs. And one of the first ones was working as an usher in the movie theater, at which time I started to see a lot of films.
Your first film role was in the movie Deliverance. Did you have any reservations about making your screen debut in a role where the character is raped by a man?
No. It, as far as I can recall, never occurred to me. As a matter of fact, I was sort of, in a way, shocked by how people reacted to that. I was shocked, as a matter of fact, even when we filmed it, how difficult it was for the crew. There were people who didn't want to do the scene. At that point, my feeling about my work, my craft, my art, if you will, was the fact that I simply served the story. So it wasn't in my lexicon of thinking about acting whether or not I was going to be identified with this character and what happened to him.
You mentioned how surprised you were at the cameraman's horrified reaction to the rape scene in Deliverance. And do you think it's a combination of two things? One, the humiliation of rape, but two, a certain amount of homophobia?
I really think it had to do with how well we did the scene.
That's a
terribly egotistical answer. I think we did it well. The actor who played the rapist, Bill McKinney, is a wonderful actor, and I think it's a scene that would bother anyone. I don't know it has anything to do with homophobia at all. I think it has to do with seeing any time we act out violence and we do it anywhere near how it might actually happen, that's frightening. Because what we've seen is we've seen a lot of violence in films and television over the years, which has no reality to it. When you do a scene that does have some reality to it, it can be very, very riveting.
I think your career proves that it's not the size of the role, but what the role is and how you play it that counts. And I'm thinking specifically of your role in Network, for which you got nominated for an Academy Award as Best Supporting Actor. Now, how many minutes were you actually on the screen in that movie?
Well, it must have been less than 3, I would think. Well, let's say between 3 and 4 minutes at the outset.
I think it's pretty amazing to get nominated for an Academy Award for a role that lasts under 3 minutes.
It is, but I must tell you, anytime you read a play or a film script, and they talk about your character for pages and pages and pages before you appear, that's like a license. That's like a license to steal. It's wonderful when they talk about you for a long time before you get there. That's like having been on screen all that time. And this particular character was focused on a lot by a wonderful actor named Robert Duvall, who talked about me all the time and his fear of me. And you can't get a better setup in the world than having Robert Duvall's character talk about your character before you come on. That's the best.
Do you think that people in Hollywood talk about such a thing as a Ned Beatty type?
Oh, I suspect they do. You know, there's that old saw about, who's Ned Beatty, how's it go? Who's Ned Beatty? Get me Ned Beatty. Get me a Ned Beatty type. I suspect I'm at the get me a Ned Beatty type stage, yes.
So what do you think a Ned Beatty type is?
Oh, I don't know. I hope they're thinking in terms of an actor. I've always liked to think that one of the reasons I've been very fortunate is because I have been typecast as an actor rather than as a particular type of character. And I would hope that if they're looking for a Ned Beatty type, they're looking for someone who can do a few different turns, which I think all actors can do. I wish actors had, all of us had more of an opportunity to show different sides of what we can do as performers. But I would hope that's what, I suspect a Ned Beatty type is a guy who's, gone past middle age and is overweight, I suspect.
Well, do things like age and weight affect a lot the kind of roles that you're offered? Do you ever feel limited by your physical presence?
No. Yes. I'd be silly to say no. Yes, you do feel that. I must admit, lately I felt so much more limited by the problems of storytelling.
Bad scripts, you mean?
Well, I didn't want to say it exactly.
Too diplomatic.
but no, I mean, I don't know if it's a matter of bad or good. I think we're having real storytelling problems in my business. I think storytellers of all forms are having problems these days because I think when you don't, when there's a lot of misgivings about the value systems and not knowing what it is we want to tell each other stories about, storytelling becomes very difficult. I think that's what's happening to us right now.
Did you ever go to drama school?
No, I didn't. I don't know whether it would have done me a great deal of good. I wasn't a very good student ever of anything.
Do you think you have a different acting style from people who you've worked with who are graduates of the Yale School of Drama or who studied the method?
Well, I don't think so. Luckily enough, my university was the theater. And I got to work with actors who worked all kinds of different styles, with directors who worked in all sorts of different ways. I think I picked up on, through reading and through working, picked up on most of the ideas and thoughts about my trade and in those years. What most actors do when they have some experience and have a chance to work around a bit is they pick what works for them. And, and one of the nice things about being an actor is it's never the same. You're never playing exactly the same scene or exactly the same character. And you get to try out different techniques from time to time. I know sometimes I'll pull something out of the sack that maybe I haven't used in 20 years and dust it off and see if this will work. There's a little trick about music. Stanislavski talked about it, and some other acting teachers talked about it, that music can have such a strong and almost kinetic attachment to our emotional system. Sometimes you can just think of a little phrase of a song and it'll get a whole thing going inside you. And every once in a while, when I'm having trouble with, getting the right feeling for a scene, I'll look around for that little piece of melody.
Is there a specific song you've used in certain roles?
There's one that always comes to my mind because I got so tickled when it worked for me. And I will tell you what it is and you may take from it what you will. But I used to be able to become immediately and violently angry when I would hum a little ditty that we haven't heard so much in recent years called Ain't She Sweet.
Why would that make you angry?
I don't know why it works.
It's a little pop confection.
Yeah, I don't want to analyze it too deeply, but something about bum, 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 da 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 bum, bum, that just turns, I can get every hair on my head standing on end practically by humming that to myself.
I think that's really funny.
Yeah, it is.
I'll always think of you when I hear that song. You were telling us a little bit about your performance in Deliverance. One of your latest roles was in The Big Easy.
Yes.
Did you prepare for that role differently than you did for Deliverance? Because by the time you were cast in The Big Easy, you were a seasoned veteran. Deliverance was your very first film role. Had you changed a lot in terms of your acting style?
Well, I don't know. I felt very strong as an actor when I did Deliverance. Some of the stories that I could tell on myself about the filming of that movie sort of make my own hair curl. It's curly already, but makes it curl worse. I had a great deal of hubris as an actor at that point. I really felt like, after 15 years in the theater and having been lucky enough to play a lot of different kind of parts, that I could do just about anything as an actor that I chose to do. So I didn't have any doubts about myself. I hopefully nowadays have a few more doubts about what I can do and what I can't do.
Ned Beatty, I thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you, Jerry.
Actor Ned Beatty can be seen in the forthcoming movie Switching Channels with Kathleen Turner and Burt Reynolds. This is Fresh Air. You can hear full coverage of today's news on All Things Considered. John Hockenberry, who's co-hosting the program, is joining us from Washington. Hi, John.
Hi, Terry.
What story is he following?
Tonight, the president met with Congress today on a plan for bringing down the deficit, something with a lot of urgency now with the market in such turmoil. Also, a shooting suicide of a Miami broker by a disgruntled investor who took his own life. Also, the difficulties of getting food to the hungry in war-torn Ethiopia, and a profile of a theater collaboration.
Who are the collaborators?
An American theater dance troupe and a Nigerian ensemble getting together to put on the English language premiere of a Nigerian folk opera.
Okay, well, thanks, John. Those stories and more are coming up on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Every network is running at least one major miniseries in November in an attempt to boost ratings during the November sweeps. This Sunday and Monday, CBS is offering one, Echoes in the Darkness. Critic David Bianculli has a review.
Echoes in the Darkness has a lot in common with Fatal Vision, the excellent docudrama miniseries shown in 1984. Both are true stories about grisly murders. In both cases, the primary murder suspects appear to be totally respectable. A doctor in Fatal Vision, a high school principal in Echoes in the Darkness. And what's most important, none of the convicted murderers in these cases ever confessed. That's what makes the TV dramatization so tricky. If you stage the crime for TV, you're playing a dangerous guessing game, no matter how well-informed that guess might be. And if you don't stage the crime, what's the point in dramatizing it at all? Well, the point, as CBS's Echoes in the Darkness proves, is that you can produce a fascinating, exciting murder story without murdering the truth. Echoes in the Darkness is about the 1978 murder of Susan Reinert, an English teacher at Upper Merion High School about an hour from Philadelphia. She and her two children, ages 10 and 11, disappeared one weekend, and Reinert was found 100 miles away in the back of her own car, naked, injected with morphine, covered with bruises and signs of bondage, and dead. A search for her killer or killers and the missing children eventually led to a group of colleagues at the high school. Specifically, to fellow teacher Bill Bradfield and his loyal friends and followers, and to the principal, Jay Smith, who is so bizarre he almost makes Bradfield seem normal. Robert Loggia plays Smith with frightening coldness, as in this courtroom scene, when Smith is asked about his reference book collection.
As a matter of fact, you had three books on Ted Bundy, didn't you? And the book Fatal Vision.
I consider Ted Bundy to be one of the first major serial murderers.
Correct me if I'm wrong, Doctor, but isn't Fatal Vision about a doctor who kills a woman and her two children?
No. It was about his wife and two children.
Well, she was still a woman, wasn't she?
Of course she was a woman.
Another connection with Fatal Vision is that Gary Cole, who played the convicted murderer in that miniseries, plays one of the central investigators in Echoes in the Darkness. Treat Williams, the marvelous actor who was questioning Smith in the scene you just heard, plays Deputy Attorney General Rick Guida, and Peter Boyle has a plum role as old-fashioned cop Joe Van Noort. The amazing thing, though, is that Joseph Wambaugh's teleplay, based on his own book, doesn't even introduce the cops until the first installment is just about over. Instead, the first 2 hours are spent leading up to the murder, letting us know the people involved. It's a solid cast. Stockard Channing plays Susan Reinert, the eventual victim. Peter Coyote plays the spooky Bill Bradfield. And Cindy Pickett plays Bradfield's longtime housemate. Wambaugh's only liberties with the facts are to change the name of one young student with whom Bradfield was romantically involved and ignore another whose part in the story was largely peripheral. Other than that, Wambaugh's version has the strange ring of truth. So many confusing or improbable things happen that no dramatist would dare invent them. And the courtroom testimony is so flat-out weird that it's mesmerizing. Treat Williams, Peter Coyote, and Robert Loggia are all wonderful, and Cole is as good here in a very different role as he was in Fatal Vision. Fatal Vision got around the lack of a confession by dramatizing the murder from several points of view. Echoes in the Darkness gets around it by never showing the murder at all. It's an admirable show of restraint that makes Echoes in the Darkness an admirable show.
David Bianculli is television critic for the New York Post. Here's a look at tomorrow's fresh air. Tomorrow, I'll speak with crime writer Patricia Highsmith. Alfred Hitchcock adapted a movie from her first novel, Strangers on a Train. She's just published her 19th novel. It's titled Found in the Street. Rock historian Ed Ward will look at the songs the Beatles gave away, the songs Lennon and McCartney wrote for other Liverpool bands. And book critic John Leonard will review The Dresden Gate, the new novel by Michael Schmidt that explores the legacy of the European presence in Latin America. So I hope you can join us. We thank everyone who helps make Fresh Air possible.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced.
Our senior producer is Danny Miller. Our producers are Amy Salad, Phyllis Myers, and Naomi Person. Ed Doherty and Lisa Bruton are our production assistants. Chris Spurgeon directs the show. Our engineer is Joyce Lieberman. I'm Terry Gross. Thanks for listening. This is NPR, National Public Radio.